About Emerald Ash Borer. My name is David Wick, and I'm a district technician here at the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District. Today, I am joined by Jonathan Osthaus from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and Eric Lindberg from Rainbow Ecoscience. Welcome. So before we kind of get into things in the Emerald Ash Borer, EAB, as we call it for short, it'd be great if you guys could just tell me a little bit about your positions, what you do, where you started, just so people can have a bit of an understanding of where you're coming from and what your expertise is. So, Jonathan, if you wouldn't mind starting things off, that'd be great.
Well, thanks for having me. I am the Emerald Ash Borer Technical Assistance Coordinator for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So I'm typically one of the first points of contact for a community once Emerald Ash Borer is first detected. And so I started at the Department of Agriculture way back now in 2009, about a month after Emerald Ash Borer was found in St. Paul, Minnesota. So I've kind of been working on this and watching it and tracking the spread of Emerald Ash Borer throughout Minnesota since it was first detected.
Eric, you can follow him up.
Thanks. Just like Jonathan indicated, thanks for having me on here. So Eric Lindberg with Rainbow Ecoscience. I've been with the Rainbow Ecoscience for about 6 years now. And my role is lead technical advisor. And so with that, I work a lot with governments, municipal entities on invasive species management plans. And that's anything from kind of the beginning stages of it when they're, kind of the heat of things, and helping influence, some different sort of management decisions. In addition to that, I do a lot of educational events throughout the country. I'm just educating people about Emerald Ash Borer like we're doing today. And work a lot to help implement some of the chemical treatments to treat against Emerald Ash Borer and save some of the ash trees.
Oh, great. I appreciate you guys taking the time to sit down and talk EAB. So I think before we kind of get into some of the interesting stuff, we got to cover the biology. Where does it come from? How did it get here? And just kind of get a little bit of that background information. So Jonathan, I know I've listened to a couple conversations with you about all of the background and where did it come from, how did it get here. So if you wouldn't mind just kind of starting that off, I'll let you run with it.
I'll just kind of give you a broad background of it. So it's a metallic wood-boring beetle. It's in the family Buprestidae, and it was found in Detroit, Michigan, back in 2002. So its native range is Eastern Asia, so parts of northeastern China, the Russian Far East, North and South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. So that's kind of its native range. And it likely arrived sometime in the early 90s or to mid-90s. They're not quite sure exactly when it was introduced, but it likely came via solid wood packaging material in through the ports of Detroit, Michigan, and Windsor, Ontario. And so, like I mentioned, it wasn't identified until 2002. So it basically had a decade of unmitigated growth. And so lots of ash nursery stock and firewood and things like that were dispersed throughout the country to many new locations, kind of kicking off that rapid spread of the insect throughout North America. And so, like I mentioned earlier, it was found in St. Paul, Minnesota in 2009. So we're kind of entering that 14th year since it was originally detected in Minnesota. So it's really started to kick into high gear in the Twin Cities metro area and southern Minnesota in general. And of course, spots in the Northeast, in Duluth, Minnesota as well.
Okay. Eric, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think that's a really great explanation of it. Big thing is, like, it's a small beetle. It's really crazy to think that something that's only about a quarter inch in size can cause this much destruction throughout the United States. As Jonathan indicated, with them not knowing what they even had, it was just all of a sudden all these ash trees are dying. And it's like, what's going on. And you see all these little galleries and underneath those trees. And with that much time being implemented before like discovering it, yeah, so much material got shipped out throughout the country and it just really spread.
Right. And just on top of that, the insect itself is very cryptic in nature. So, I mean, you don't see any symptoms in a tree until it's already been there for a couple of years. And even at that, like, you still have to really kind of know what you're looking for to be able to spot it early on. That, you know, it's once it's in an area, it's already been there for several years by the time you can identify it.
That's always the hard part, too. Yeah. Like, and I usually tell people, you know, for emerald ash borer, a lot of times you can probably go your entire life and maybe not even see the beetle itself. And I've only actually seen it once. And that was because I found a dead one outside on my deck. And so I've kept it. I have it in a little canister because I figured it's like, all right, now I have something to show people. Mm-hmm. But it's fairly elusive. It's, you know, that small little beetle causes so much damage, but it's really not seen a lot by people in the general public, unless you're up in that tree.
Right. And I have you beat by a couple. I've seen it 3 times, just actually flying around and hanging out on a tree. And so that's over 14 years. You know.
Well, and in my short 5 years, I've never seen emerald ash borer, but I have seen the bronze birch borer. And I was absolutely flabbergasted when it, you know, it landed on my car window and I did a triple take there. Just, you know, they're so little. And why did this just all of a sudden land here? And it's totally amazing when you see something like that. So thank you guys. So, you know, this is coming from the, you know, Russian Far East, China, Asia. You know, do they have similar problems like we're having, you know, with it killing the ash trees? Are there natural predators? You know, are they dealing with similar issues that we're having? Can you guys talk on that a little bit?
Sure. Like, so China did plant green ash, so Fraxinus pennsylvanica, and, you know, that's getting hammered by emerald ash borer as well. But, you know, they have a host of natural enemies, natural enemy complex that help keep the populations in check in China and the Russian Far East. So they have many parasitic wasp species that co-evolved with emerald ash borer in its native range that help reduce those populations to keep it from having these kind of basically population explosions like we have here in the U.S.
Yeah, that's a good explanation of it. It's mainly, it's not, emerald ash borer is not as big of a deal over in, you know, China and those Asian countries, because as Jonathan indicated, that they've co-evolved with it and they have some of these natural predators that help keep those populations in check. That's one of the big reasons why emerald ash borer has been such a nuisance here is it's very good at reproducing. You know, one female can lay between the kind of 60 to 80 eggs, and about 90% of those are viable. And that's with kind of no natural predator defenses. And so if left unchecked, when it's first introduced into an area like here where they have no natural defenses against it, and the Fraxinus pennsylvanica, the green ash, you know, is a perfect host for it. In 5 years' time, you know, that population just grows exponentially. And that's how we get such these big issues happening with it. But I like to think of it a lot like almost kind of like two-line chestnut borer here. So like two-line chestnut borer is an agrilis beetle that's in the flathead borer, the Buprestidae family. And it absolutely will cause, you know, the decline and, you know, destroy some of the oaks here. But it's native here and the populations are held in check with a couple of different factors. It's just whenever you have an invasive pest that hasn't co-evolved with the species here, with the other, you know, predators around it to help keep those populations in check, that this is the outcome of it. There's no natural defenses against emerald ash borer here, and it just kills millions upon millions of ash trees.
Yeah, we have a couple native parasitoid wasps that will attack emerald ash borer once those populations really explode. But at that point, there's already millions of emerald ash borer around the area. And the main one, Tanacolus simplex, it's a solitary parasitoid. So it's really just a one for one there. It, you know, for one larvae that's parasitized, it's, you know, it only produces one wasp from that. So that's, it really can't build up to populations to exert any sort of control over emerald ash borer.
Yeah. So when you guys are talking parasitoid wasps, just so people can understand, are we talking yellow jacket size? Are we talking mosquito size? Is this something that'll attack humans? Is this something people should be concerned about?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I would call them non-stinging. So a Tanacolus is, you know, I think about 5 millimeters big. It's not all that big. It's not something you'd have to worry about being stung by. It's not something you're going to interact or see at all when you're out, maybe walking around in the woods or something like that. We do have a biological control program for emerald ash borer. So we do have three types of parasitoid species that we do release to try to reduce emerald ash borer populations. And those were found through federal research expeditions to its native range in northeastern China and the Russian Far East. And so that's something we've been doing actually since 2010. And the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is the main coordinator for those releases in the state of Minnesota. So I'll just expand a little bit more on that. So the three parasitoid species that we release, two of them are larval parasitoids. So they range from about 3 millimeters big to about 5 millimeters big, and they attack the emerald ash borer larvae that are underneath the bark. And then we also have one egg parasitoid called Obeis agrilli that we release that attacks the emerald ash borer eggs. And we have been able to get them established in the southeastern part of the state and Twin Cities and in Duluth. So we are doing work on that. We're continually looking each year for new sites. Typically what we need for a good release site is at least 40 acres of forest land with a 25% ash component, really, we need a mixed size classes. So one of the parasitoids that has done the best so far, Tetrascus planipennis, the larval parasitoid, has a short ovipositor and can't get through really thick bark. So it needs those smaller trees to be able to reproduce and find those emerald ash borer larvae and reproduce.
We'll
let Eric jump in here.
I was going to say really great explanations with that. And just kind of for the listening audience to provide some context, when we're talking about emerald ash borer and the discussion and the destruction that it does, it's not actually the adult that is doing all of it. The adults that you will typically see from kind of like news media or whenever we're talking about it, those are mainly just feeding on the leaves. And that's not causing the decline. The decline in these ash trees happens when they lay the eggs and the larvae kind of burrow in, and they're kind of feeding on some of that inner tissue inside of that tree. And what happens is as those populations start growing, you have multiple larvae inside of there that just kind of keep on eating in the inside until eventually the tree is just kind of compromised. It can't move water and nutrients up into the canopy, and so it dies. And so it's actually that larval stage that is causing kind of all of this destruction. And so by having some of those, I think targeting those larval stages as well as those egg stages are a great thing to be doing.
Right. And then we just got kind of a new research update from one of the main biological control researchers, Dr. Julie Gould, based out of the Otis lab with the USDA APHIS. And so they're finding that you can't even release these parasitoids after that main wave of EAB has gone through an area and killed a lot of the mature ash trees in a forest. So it can still get established within that kind of those small ash that are still present and that kind of regen that's starting to happen. So that is good news for areas because there's a limited number of parasitoids that can be produced per year and put out there. And so that is a good news for forests that have already had emerald ash borer run through it. So,
and I think it's an interesting thing that you kind of brought up is that, that's research that just came out now. And so for people to understand like this research, like, you know, we know a lot and we know more than we did when this first was established here in the United States, but we're still learning. We don't have all the answers just yet. And so this is a continuous process that we're trying new things, trying to find, more effective things and just to continue our understanding of how we can best manage this.
Yeah, great point. And that's kind of just it's why we really do need to do the work to try to slow the spread of this insect, because we are making advancements and there will be better options in the future for ways to deal with this insect pest.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome, guys. So you guys said a word a while back, fraxinus, and you were talking about green ash. Can you talk about why fraxinus is such an important word? Why, you know, what does emerald ash borer attack? You said green ash, but does that include, you know, our mountain ash, our white ash? You know, what are our ash resources that we should be concerned about? Who does emerald ash borer attack? If landowners have oaks and maples, are those at risk as well? So just kind of talk me through what a landowner should be concerned about if they have ash or they suspect they have ash trees on their property.
With that, and this is where I become somewhat of a scientific name snob for the situations that you're talking about right now. And so Fraxinus is a genus. It's a taxonomic classification that people will use to identify different kind of species. And with that, there's a difference between a mountain ash is in a completely different family. And so that is something that while it has ash in the name, it's not a true kind of taxonomic botanical ash per se. And with that, emerald ash borer does not go after that. But like white ash, that is a Fraxinus species. That one, it does. And emerald ash borer is pretty host specific. It really goes over and attacks members of that Fraxinus genus, those different types of ashes, excluding mountain ash. There was some research that found that it does attack some trees of other species, but the numbers aren't as high. Some of those would be like white fringe tree, which I don't think we really have here in Minnesota. And there was some recent research that came out, this is a couple years ago, this is in relation to over in California, they were looking into, you know, how is emerald ash borer going to pack them? And I believe there was some members of the Liliaceae family, some like these kind of olive trees that it actually was able to reproduce in. Now, that being said, you know, these are not this preferred host. The preferred hosts are the ash trees that we're talking about here today. And if I have, and I have an ash tree in my front yard, that's the only species that I'm going to be concerned with. You don't need to be concerned with any of the other species because with it, there's so many ash here, that's going to be their number one go-to place to attack and to feed on. And with the other species that it's been found to be able to reproduce with, it's their fecundity. And fecundity is just another word for kind of how successful they are at reproducing. Their rates are decreased quite a bit, so it's not as successful there. So it's really pretty host specific.
Great. So people only need to be concerned if they've got the green ash, the white ash, or the black ash on their property, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Great. So you guys also chatted about some natural predators. And I talk with a lot of people that think, well, you know, I have increased woodpeckers, you know, on my ash tree. Are they going to be taken care of? The emerald ash borer larvae? Are the woodpeckers going to be fat and happy? And, you know, what's going on with that?
Well, yeah, so the woodpeckers, I mean, well, they can eat a lot of emerald ash borer larvae. They don't really impact the overall population. And that is actually kind of our real number one indicator that we go around looking for in the wintertime is to identify ash trees that are showing signs of woodpecker damage because they do like to eat those late instar larvae underneath the bark. You know, you can see they've, you know, found up to, you know, over 30%, predation of emerald ash borer larvae in an ash tree. But like I said, you know, they're getting the larvae that are already at their late instar stage. So they've already done the majority of the damage that they're going to do in their life. And the woodpecker is doing some damage to the tree as well. So it tells you that you have an insect problem in your tree is what it does.
Yeah, that's a key thing, because if you're seeing woodpecker activity on your tree, there's a reason why that woodpecker's there. It's not blindly just going to a tree, pecking at something, hoping it finds it. there's a reason why it goes to that specific tree at that spot. It's kind of listening. It can kind of indicate that something is in there. And so whenever you're seeing woodpecker activity on an ash tree, a red flag should go up, thinking like, okay, you know, maybe something's going on there, especially if emerald ash borer is in the area. And yeah, it's a good kind of early warning sign to look for. And a term that you know, people might hear be thrown around every once in a while is called bark flecking. And that's just when that woodpecker is kind of pecking at the ash tree, it leaves behind, you know, it's a different color of wood. It's like a lighter color wood that you'll typically see. And it's pretty easy to see from the ground. And you'll typically see it more towards the top of the canopy first. But that's it's a great warning indicator that something's in there. There's a reason why it's going after it.
You guys were talking about how, you know, California is going to be active, how impacted, you know, how it spread from Detroit all across the county. So I'll give you guys a quick background. In Sherburne County, we currently have emerald ash borer in the Elk River and the Big Lake communities. And we expect the spread to continue to Zimmerman, Becker, and then, you know, continue to spread throughout the county. So where, you know, if people are outside of these immediate quarantine zones in Big Lake and Elk River, you know, they're 20 miles north, 20 miles to the west, should they be concerned about emerald ash borer? Is it there? How long, you know, do they have to wait? How's it spreading? How's it getting to them? Kind of these questions that, you know, these landowners need to know to make management decisions on their property. Kind of where should they start, you know?
Well, you should be paying attention and keeping an eye out for things like woodpecker damage, especially if you're within 20 miles of a known infestation. Just given that cryptic nature of the insect and the ways that it can be spread through human-assisted movement, besides just its traditional flight movement, you know, on its own, emerald ash borer, you know, there's some variations on how, you know, much it spreads from year natural. It's typically about 1 to 2 miles a year of a spread rate on its own. And then you can combine in there people moving infested wood. So say they had to cut down a tree in their yard and then they want to go use that wood, burn that wood up at their cabin in the summertime. That's a way that it gets spread like that. There's been research to show that emerald ash borer spreads along railroad lines, paper in Iowa that showed that. And then you just seeing where it showed up on the map in Minnesota, you have a lot of different isolated pockets of infestation that show up along major travel corridors along I-94 and I-35 and things like that. So really, you know, it could be 5 to 10 years before you see it start to impact trees on your property if within that distance, or it could be tomorrow. So really, it's not evenly distributed. It's patchy distribution. And, you know, really you just have to be pretty vigilant and start to make plans knowing that it's eventually going to spread to your area.
Yeah, it's kind of crapshoot. It's one of those things that, as Jonathan indicated, they really aren't super strong flyers. Left to their own devices, yeah, they're only traveling about, you know, kind of 2 miles at the tops with it. So you think about kind of how is it spread so much throughout the United States. And, you know, just as of last year, this was found in just outside of Portland, Oregon. It's the first time the furthest westward it was Colorado before that. And it's kind of like, how did it get there? And it definitely didn't fly there. This is where, you know, the human intervention aspect is the reason why this has been so horrible. It's been a lot of those kind of travel corridors, and just even recently, you know, earlier this year in Minnesota, EAB confirmed in Moorhead. That was a bit of a jump there too.
It was, and it showed up right along a rail line and right at a rail transfer yard. So there you have it.
So are we assuming that's coming off of infected wood, or did one of these beetles hop on a rail car and go lay some eggs up in a tree up north, or do we not even know?
It's your best guess. I mean, it's once it gets introduced in a point like that, it's really hard to trace back exactly how it arrived there, unless you have a smoking gun evidence like that just happens to be there. But yeah.
So from what you guys are telling me, you don't know when it's going to be here. So if a landowner, they have an ash tree and now they need to decide, what are we going to do? Should we cut this ash tree down? you know, what are their options? What can they do? Should they try to prevent EAB from getting there? Should they take, you know, cut the tree down, plant something else? What are some options for them?
I'll chime in at least in the beginning part. I think with it, it's if you're in an area where emerald ash borer is confirmed, especially within kind of like a 15-mile radius, that's what I like to think of as kind of like the high pressure area, because it takes a little bit for sometimes for these symptoms to show up. But usually with if you're within 50 miles, that's kind of a high pressure spot. If you have ash trees on your property, and you kind of have to make a plan. You have to decide, you know, what do these trees mean to me? Like if you have a lot of acreage and you have a bunch of ash trees, that the loss of them is not going to have a significant impact, you know, this could be a good time to remove them now. The big thing is all of our native ash trees here, if nothing is done, they are going to eventually die unless you do chemical intervention is the best way to kind of prevent this at this time. Some of these biological control methods can help keep the populations kind of at bay a bit. But to protect an individual tree, that's really the best option that's out there right now. But it's a decision. You know, if you have a lot of ash trees on your property, you know, it can get kind of expensive. And this is something that, you know, for chemical intervention that you have to do over time. So you have to decide, like, you know, is this a tree that I want? You know, there's if you have a smaller ash tree that's, you know, probably under 8 inches of diameter, I'd probably pull that thing out now and replant. But if you have some, like, you know, really well-established trees, like I have an ash tree in my front yard that is a big provider of shade over my front yard. And that's something that if I were to remove and replace that, it's going to take 20 or so years to get a tree of, you know, similar-ish to that size. And so there's a lot of, you know, kind of benefits associated with these kind of well-established trees. The great thing, at least on the kind of chemical intervention side, is there's, since EAB has been here since 2002, there's been a lot of research that has been done to really kind of get down to what are the most effective treatment methods to do. And there's a chemical that it's an active ingredient called emamectin benzoate. And that's probably one of the most widely used ones to protect these ashes against emerald ash borer. And it's applied as a tree injection. It's drilled directly into the tree and injected into there. And it provides protection for up to 2 years, sometimes in, you know, kind of a larger settings. They've seen kind of 3-year control with it. And that's where there's been a lot of research over at like Michigan State, over at Purdue and Ohio State, and implementing some of these things called SLAM, which is slowing ash mortality. And with that, it's what you're finding is, you know, treating some of the trees has a significant impact on the overall populations of things. And so there's a good kind of community-wide approach that can be established. If you know, maybe it's difficult to treat every single tree in an area, and I would never really advise that. But if some of the trees in the area are being treated, it'll help reduce some of the overall population, which will slow the overall decline of some of these ash trees, which is good. But for the homeowners that are listening today and have ash trees in their front yard, big thing is make a plan now. Determine if you like that ash tree. Great. Find a certified arborist to talk about what your options are. And if you don't like it, or you can live without it, and it's close to a house or a structure, now's a good time to remove it while it's still alive. Because the big thing is, when emerald ash borer comes and it attacks a tree, and once it completely kills it, these ash become so incredibly brittle. And with it, one of the things that I remember seeing some research findings, it's kind of like, why do these ash trees become so brittle after being attacked by emerald ash borer? And I think that there's a fungus that gets into some of the galleries that helps contribute to overall that decline, make it a little bit faster. But they become super, super brittle, and you can just be walking by and have a big limb just fall. And the big thing is, a lot of tree care workers, once it's a completely dead ash tree, they're not putting their climbers into them because it's a safety hazard. And so it becomes more of a mechanical removal, which sometimes can put the cost up with it. So if you are thinking that you do not want to have that ash tree, you want to get it removed while it's still alive, because you'll be paying a lot less for that removal than if it's a completely dead one.
Those are all great points. And just like to echo that, if you have a large tree that's, pretty relatively healthy and it's in a location next to your house, it can be, you can keep that tree healthy through treatment, for a couple decades before you ever reach what that total cost of removal would be up front. So that's something to think about as well. And just with the biological control, that's not going to protect any of your mature trees or, the trees in your yard. That is to try to keep ash in the system in the long term. It's not going to protect those mature canopy dominant trees. So it's really a play in the long term to try to keep ash present in our forests.
Yeah, and I always like to think of some of the chemical treatments. It's almost like an insurance policy. If you don't treat your tree, are you guaranteed that you're going to get attacked by emerald ash borer? No. If you treat your tree, are you guaranteed it's going to be attacked by emerald ash borer? No. It's not a guarantee, but there's, we can go by probabilities. There's a high likelihood of some of this. But the only way to ensure that it will be protected is by kind of sometimes taking out that insurance policy and treating it. As Jonathan had indicated, one of the really great things is we've been able to, the cost for some of these chemical treatments is much lower than what it used to be. And additionally with it too, you can treat, sometimes up to about 30 years in some cases for the same cost of some of these removals. So it's all about the plan of what you want for your trees.
Awesome. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say it's gonna be a choice, individual choice for each property owner situation.
Okay. So you talk about injections. You said certified arborists. So are these injections, do they need to be done by a certified arborist? Could some landowners save some money and do it themselves? Would you recommend that? Is it legally even possible? So talk me through that process.
I can say for our company, we provide products and equipment to accomplish some of this. And we have a product called Mectinite, which contains 4% amivectin benzoate. That is not a restricted use pesticide. It is a general use pesticide. So it is something that a homeowner can apply on their own at their own property. If you're ever doing chemical treatments for a company or, taking money for it, that you need to have a pesticide applicator's license. And in any of these cases, I think if you are going to be doing some tree injections on your own, it's probably good to go get a pesticide applicator's license because there's a lot of intricacies with these things. With that, so a homeowner could do this on their own. Usually the limiting factor, I don't recommend it unless you have a lot of land. If you have a lot of land with a lot of ash trees, if you contract that out to a company, the cost of that can really go up. And so it might be to your benefit to invest money in equipment and product and do those treatments yourself. But for the average homeowner that maybe has 1 to 3 ash trees on their property, it's not worth it to invest money into like an injection equipment and the chemical, because it's a higher investment cost there. It's really probably cheaper to contract out for a tree care company to do the work. And a lot of times I like to suggest, certified arborists are good. Those are people that have a certification through the International Society of Arboriculture. And those are generally what I usually suggest for people to go for.
Great. And if landowners are looking for resources for this, feel free to reach out to the SWCD. We do have a list of certified arborists that can handle emerald ash borer management. So don't hesitate to reach out with questions.
That's great. I'm glad you have a list for the county.
Yeah, it makes it easy.
Yeah.
So anything are you guys aware? Go ahead.
Just say anything you can do to make it as easy as possible for people to find the resources they need is a good thing.
Absolutely. So knowing what you guys know about emerald ash borer, can we apply any of these lessons, these treatments to any future other invasive species managements, you know, that are on their way into Minnesota? Can we prepare for other things? Are there any kind of strategies we're going to, lessons we've learned that we're going to apply to the next wave of issues that is here to plague our trees in Minnesota?
Well, I'll just start with, you know, this isn't going to be the last, you know, major forest pest that comes through and impacts our Minnesota forests. So really try to avoid monocultures. Diversity is very key, especially in community forests, and avoiding replanting the one or two blocks with all the same species. So really try to be diverse in your replantings and take note of what else is around you in your neighborhood and try to bury it. That'll provide a much better backstop it to not be as impacted for the next pest that comes through.
That is huge. Absolutely. Diversity is really key. Because before Emerald Ash Borer, for some of the listeners who might be a little bit older, like Dutch elm disease. And Dutch elm disease is still present, but at the time, you know, back in like the 60s, 70s, these boulevards that you saw were covered in these beautiful, gorgeous American elms, and Dutch elm disease comes in and wipes everything out because everyone had an elm in front. And the issue, what happened is we replaced a lot of those elms with ash. And all it takes is, you know, one of these pests to come in that is so specific. And, you know, Minnesota, I believe, has some of the largest population of ash trees out of any state, kind of per area. Do you know? Am I right there, Jonathan?
We have about 1 billion ash trees. So the most out of any state in the lower 48.
Yeah.
So, and we have a massive ash resource.
And with it as well, and this is where, like, especially here in Minnesota, why Emerald Ash Borer can be such a big deal. Because in some of these municipalities that I work with, and I've been working with some areas over in Fargo, and I know one of the city municipalities that's pretty close is 40% ash. 40% of their canopy in that city is ash, and I've seen higher before. And that's the issue. It's like, if you have something that comes in that can take away 40% of that, the impact is massive. But if you're implementing some of this diversity in these new plantings, there are so many really great native trees that will do well here. Then the impact, whenever these invasives come in, is going to be a little bit smaller. I will say this is just one of my, I think most arborists will probably agree, but not everyone needs an autumn blaze maple. I understand that some of the color, the fall foliage is really, really nice. But if we keep doing that on every single tree, all it's going to take is when's the next maple borer coming in?
There's Asian longhorn beetle that's already established in areas in the East Coast. And yeah, that requires a lot of tree removals once it's found in an area. So it's be diverse in your plantings.
Are you guys aware of what our most highly planted tree is right now in the Twin Cities? Is it maples like you're talking, or are we pretty diverse already and we just need to keep that train rolling?
It's gonna vary a lot by neighborhood and city. I can't speak to the general makeup of the whole area, but I mean, we do have a lot of maple that's already probably overrepresented in most communities. So,
yeah, I think the big thing is, like, you know, these are the, you know, these lessons learned, and that diversity is really the key thing. And a lot of municipalities have been doing a good job at implementing some of that. But to a point, I think there's always areas where we can do better. And with it, for the homeowners, for your own individual trees that you plant, is just being mindful of that. You know, maybe talking to an arborist about what would be some good trees to plant in your area. You know, maybe you might be surprised. There's some pretty cool trees out there. it's hard to say, kind of like it. I agree with Jonathan. It's more kind of, you know, city by city by city by neighborhood is going to be unique in itself, and, like, you know, where the tree plantings are happening. But just diversity is key. That's huge.
Well, thank you. And on that note of diversity and diversifying our forests and our neighborhoods, I think we'll kind of put our conversation to an end. So I want to thank you guys for joining me today. And I really appreciate you guys taking the time to chat Emerald Ash Borer. And we kind of ended it on more maples and other species. But I think everyone listening got a great idea of, you know, what Emerald Ash Borer is, how is it going to impact them, and then kind of that take-home message of what do they need to go do now? And they need to go make a plan, figure out what ash trees they want to keep. Do I have ash trees in the first place? Or should I start thinking about removal and replacement? So thank you guys so much. If any landowners that are listening have questions, feel free to reach out to myself. If you have questions specifically for Eric or Jonathan, I can absolutely put you in contact with them. Otherwise, thanks for listening. And again, thank you, Eric. Thank you, Jonathan. And have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, David. Appreciate your time. Mm-hmm.